Yep. 1320 WILS, 619. We're getting more and more information now about what occurred in Manchester, specifically with the bomber himself, Salman Abedi. It was the bomber. Now his brother has been arrested. His father also. We find that he went to Libya and was there just days before he came back to England and committed this atrocity. Let's talk to a man that knows really more about radicalization and de-radicalization than anyone in the world. Mubin Sheikh is with us. He's testified as an expert for the United States Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs. He's the co-author of the acclaimed book, Undercover Jihad. Mubin, great to have you on WILS.
Thank you for having me, sir.
There was a point in your life where you were an extremist also, right?
Yeah, well, there was. I mean, I'm born and raised in Toronto, Canada, went through an identity crisis, and eventually turned to extreme religiosity, which then took me further into extremist religiosity.
And you end up going to Pakistan, and you met with the Taliban, is that right?
That's right. 1995, I was 19 years old, in the middle of, smack dab in the middle of my identity crisis. And I saw these guys who, you know, seemed to me to be heroes of an age gone by.
What's the draw when you're that age, and what's the messaging? What are they telling you that really draws you in?
Well, it's exactly like joining a gang, right? It's the sense of being powerful coming out of a sense of powerlessness. It's the idea that you belong to a greater community, a greater group of brothers. You know, that becomes your new family, and you spend all your time with them. You begin to imitate them. You begin to, you know, reinforce the ideas that they're saying. Mm-hmm. So the dynamics are the same, whether you're joining a terrorist group or a gang.
And with this bomber, Salman Abedi, he was born in England. How do they manage to get him to be, you know, to view his fellow countrymen in such an inhumane way that he would do this?
Well, you know, there's always an interplay between ideology, grievances. Sometimes ideology is a driver, but other times it's just a passenger with other psychosocial factors as the driver. So looking at this guy's case in particular, and just what I was saying about gangs, I mean, more information that we've learned is he was in a gang. You know, he was taking drugs. He was never very religious. So it seems he was indoctrinated into that kind of violent mentality already. Mm-hmm. Secondly, if it is true that the father is a Salafi jihadist, that the brother is similarly extremist, then it's no surprise that he would have also rebounded into this kind of extreme religiosity. Mm-hmm. And when you do that, one of the ideas is you're living with non-Muslims, they're not, you know, you demonize them. And demonizing an entire community or an entire group of people mm-hmm. is one of the first steps you take before you actually start to attack that community.
How much is this whole idea of, how many versions is it? 70 or so, right?
Yeah, 72, man. Yeah, 72. They're all Star Trek fans.
How much of that do you think really is a driver for these suicide bombers, this belief?
You know, it depends, right? I mean, especially when you're dealing with young males who are under this idea that, you know, having girlfriends is not okay, even talking to girls is not okay. How do you tell a young kid whose hormones are raging not to talk to girls, right? Not to engage and interact with the opposite sex? So what happens is it's almost like a form of sexual nihilism, that the only way you're actually going to get any is after you kill yourself.
Okay, he grew up in England. So he knew, right? I mean, when you grow up in a Western country, you have a sense of the culture. I mean, how do you think he would have fallen back to this belief then?
Yes, that's right. I mean, and I think he probably would have seen, I mean, obviously he did see women and girls and whatever else, but he could never obtain that. You see, he could never have that for himself. And so he develops, it's almost like a form of jealousy against that society, which is providing these women, but I can't have any of those women. So that demonization, and again, it comes with the ideology, this notion that these are immoral, evil people, and you can kill them because of that.
Talking to Mubin Sheikh here on 1320 WILS. And so when you were involved on that end of things, Were you willing to put your life on the line for jihad?
Yeah, my construct was to go and fight overseas, and my time was 1995 is when I started, and so the first thing that came out of that was, as you mentioned, the Taliban. The Taliban was that gateway group, if you will. But then remember, 1996 was the Chechnya invasion by the Russians. That was the first real discussion of foreign jihad, and I expressed interest to want to go and fight there. In 1998, Osama bin Laden came out with his fatwa against the Crusaders, so we started to think, hey, maybe we could go and join him and fight in his cause. And so that's the kind of mentality I was in. But thank God, I did not engage in any violent action.
What snapped you out of it?
Well, ultimately what happened, 9/11 was my breaking point. I realized that there's something fundamentally wrong with flying planes into buildings. And I went to study my religion properly with, qualified Islamic scholars who debunked my deviant interpretations. And I realized that I had it wrong the whole time. I felt really bad. And I returned back to Canada and began working with the Canadian Security Intelligence Service as an undercover operator for a few years.
Okay. Now, is this something you think anyone that's been radicalized can go through, this de-radicalization?
It's a case-by-case basis. You cannot force de-radicalization. The person has to have had, their own moment of enlightenment, at least the first spark, and then you can, help it along.
Right.
But again, case-by-case basis, you can't force de-radicalization in people.
Okay, but they know what they're about to do and the effect it's going to have on people around them, right?
Well, I think they know, but they don't care because their objective is a higher one as they see it. This is called a sidestepping mechanism. How do you get around the fact that, wait a second, there's little kids here. There's like children here. How do you, no, don't think like that. They are kuffar. They are infidels and you can kill them. And so that objection is sidestepped.
The fact that his father and brother were arrested, do you think his father encouraged him to do this also then?
I don't know. I can't say. Certainly from what we're learning about him, he's not exactly the best kind of guy, character-wise and religious views-wise.
Mm.
So it's possible that he took inspiration from his father in that he sees his father as this religious guy and maybe he was this hedonistic, drug-taking, non-religious guy. Well, here's a great way for you to make your father proud or whatever his handlers may have told him.
Yeah.
But we don't know. We don't know the direct role the father may or may not have played.
You say that you can't really de-radicalize somebody, force them into that. So what do you do? If you're dealing with radicalized Islamists, what's the best way to neutralize them?
Well, I think the first line of defense is the Muslim community, to confront these individuals, to challenge their views, and to give them peer support. If you just rip a guy out of his ideology, now you've created a vacuum, right? And that person may rebound into another kind of extremism or may become, the other extreme, become an atheist. In the middle is where they will begin to fall when communities go and approach them. That's one approach. Teachers, who might see this, if teachers are listening, you just be the teacher, right? Your job is not to be the spy or the investigator. But if you do feel that, look, my words might not be enough, I need to pass this off the chain, then you're well within your right to do that. And the last line of defense is, of course, the tip of the spear. And that is the police, the military, the intelligence agencies.
Yeah,
by then, it's too late.
Do you think typically mosques know who is radicalized or on their way to becoming radicalized?
Mosques are definitely watching out for these people. It is truly a false stereotype that radicalization occurs at mosques. Because, look, these are public institutions. Charitable organizations, they know that if they have some guy lipping off from the pulpit, they're going to have their charity license revoked and all sorts of unwanted attention.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually vigilant at looking at who these people are. They do. They will try to approach them. It depends on how well trained the imam is, how well vigilant the community itself is.
And in terms
so there
of,
are mechanisms in place.
Yeah, less than a minute here, but in terms of the imams themselves, do they really say enough to dissuade people from this path?
Well, I mean, you know, they can always say more, but I think for the most part, they are. They are trying to do their part, the vast majority. I mean, you do have radical imams, so-called imams, unqualified, unregistered imams. Mm-hmm. They're the people that we need to keep watching.
Mubin Sheikh, one of the world's leading experts on radicalization and de-radicalization. He's the co-author of the acclaimed book, Undercover Jihadi. Undercover Jihadi. Mubin Sheikh, right here on 1320 WILS. Mubin, thank you very much.
Thank you. God bless.
Yep, 6:30, 1320 WILS. When we get back, we'll find out what the media completely ignored, why they didn't talk about the secret connections between us and Saudi Arabia. That is next on WILS.